This morning is Wright versus Wall. Ms. Griffin?
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Colleen Griffin from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent in this case. The petitioner in this case was charged and convicted of various crimes, including murder, arising from the 1983 attack on Carol Specht and her daughter Connie in their home, and he was also sentenced to death that same year. Following his direct appeal and his proceedings on his first post-conviction petition, petitioner filed a habeas corpus petition in 1993. Proceedings on the habeas petition were stayed after petitioner went back to state court and filed a second post-conviction petition. Once the proceedings on the second post-conviction petition were concluded, proceedings on the habeas corpus petition resumed. Following arguments in this case, the district court granted habeas relief on petitioner's claim that the trial court believed that as a matter of law it was precluded from considering the evidence presented as mitigation of the petitioner's horrible childhood. The district court denied relief on all other claims. The district court granted a new sentencing hearing but stated order pending resolution of this appeal. The district court also subsequently granted a certificate of appealability on the issue of whether trial counsel was ineffective for failing to present evidence in support of a guilty but mentally ill verdict. It's the respondent's position that this court should reverse the district court's decision regarding the sentencing issue and affirm on all other bases. In Eddings versus Oklahoma, on which the district court and petitioner relies, the United States Supreme Court prescribed a constitutional prohibition against the wholesale exclusion of mitigating evidence. In that case, the trial court specifically stated on the record that as a matter of law, it believed that it could not consider evidence of the petitioner's troubled childhood in mitigation. The United States Supreme Court took that as a clear indication that the trial court believed it was precluded from even considering the evidence. The opinion in Eddings has been subsequently discussed by the United States Supreme Court in both Saffold versus Parks and Barkley versus Florida, where they clarified that Eddings does not establish any weight to be given any particular evidence, but only establishes that the evidence must not be given no weight at all. It must not be barred from consideration. In the habeas corpus context, the United States Supreme Court has stated in Parker versus Duggar that a habeas petitioner is entitled to relief if the federal court can discern from the record a clear indication that all mitigating evidence was not considered.
Well, here, how do we know that the court considered the childhood trauma? I mean, what can you point to in the record that shows he specifically considered that?
Well, first, the question is whether there's a clear indication that he did not consider it, but I believe that in any event, first of all, the trial court never stated, as it did in Eddings, that it was not considering the evidence. The trial court never precluded any evidence from being presented.
Except, well, how do you read the court's statement that the court is unable to determine the existence of any mitigating factors within or without the statute, with the exception of extreme mental or emotional disturbance?
The trial court in this case specifically stated it was considering all the evidence presented in aggravation and mitigation and all this evidence presented at trial. The trial court then went so far as to specifically state, quote, so the record is clear what it was not considering, which was its sympathy itself for the victim, who the victim was, outrage, and statement to the media. The trial court's subsequent statement that the only mitigating factor it could find was proper in the sense that even though this evidence was presented by the petitioner as mitigating evidence, the trial court was under no obligation to actually consider it as mitigating. The Supreme Court in Skipper versus South Carolina, and this court also has recognized that evidence of a traumatic childhood which leads the person to become what they are is not necessarily mitigating evidence. The trial court's under an obligation to look at the evidence of the childhood's upbringing, but then decide whether that's aggravating or mitigating. It's within the trial court's province. Therefore, the trial court was under no obligation to state on the record that it found this as a mitigating factor because it was under no obligation to actually find it was mitigating or that it was actually mitigating.
Well, there's no mention of that factor at all.
Correct.
And so how do we know, you know, whether he considered it mitigating or not?
We don't necessarily know that whether he found it mitigating or not. The trial court is also under no obligation to state on the record everything it finds in mitigation or aggravation. And I believe what the petitioner is trying to do here is state that merely because the trial court felt sympathy before the petitioner for having to have gone through this traumatic childhood necessarily means that the trial court had to consider the underlying basis for that sympathetic feeling as mitigating also. And again, it is the petitioner's burden to establish a clear indication that the trial court did not consider the evidence, and that simply is not present in this case. And I think that the district court even taken the trial court's first statements that it was not considering sympathy, agrees at this point that the trial court did consider everything in mitigation and aggravation and that the non-consideration of the sympathy was appropriate, but then goes on to take the subsequent trial statement that he only considered one factor to be found in mitigation, the statutory factor that petitioner was under extreme emotional distress at the time of the crime, to be a clear indication that as a matter of law, I believe it was precluded from considering his traumatic childhood. But again, the trial court was not under any obligation to find that to be mitigating. And also, I believe, as found by the Illinois Supreme Court, that you can look at the statement that he finds only one factor in mitigation as including the evidence of petitioner's traumatic childhood as far as it related to the emotional distress that he was undergoing at the time of the commission.
Was this line of argument made in the district court, the argument you're making now? And you're essentially arguing that the meaning of the sentencing judge's statements is a question of fact.
Correct.
Which was determined by the Supreme Court of Illinois.
Correct.
The district judge doesn't discuss that possibility, so I'm inquiring whether that line of argument was presented to the district judge.
Not specifically, but the argument we're making here could not really be presented to the district court because the argument I'm making here is that the district court erred in substituting its judgment for what was mitigating or not for that of the trial court. When the district court finds...
No. The district judge didn't substitute his judgment for that of the state judge. The district judge said, the state judge said X, Y, and Z, and the only reasonable way to read that is that the judge believed he could not consider mitigating circumstances. Well, whether that's what the state judge meant is, one would think, a question of fact. But that's what leads me to ask the question whether the district judge was alerted to this. I mean, we've held in other litigation that the meaning of a state judge's ambiguous statement is a question of fact. And normally one would therefore think we just figure out whether what the Supreme Court of Illinois said it meant as a fact. But it's hard to blame the district court for not doing that if nobody asked the district judge to do it.
Well,
and you don't rely even here on our circuit's principal precedent on this authority. That's Rivera against the sheriff of Cook County. Not discussed here, and my assumption is not discussed in the district court.
In the district court stated, quote, but Wright presented evidence of a horrible childhood. Surely that qualifies as mitigation. It's our main claim before this court that his statement that surely that qualified as mitigation was his substituting his judgment for what it believed as mitigating evidence for that of the trial court. And also, in the sense that if there is any ambiguity in the trial court statement, that in Wainwright versus Good, the United States Supreme Court said that a federal habeas corpus court should abide by the choice of an appellate court regarding any ambiguity. And I also
that's entirely right. That's one of the things we relied on in Rivera. But that's why I keep asking, was this raised in the district court? Are you now asking us to reverse on the ground that was not presented to the district judge?
I'm asking this court to reverse on the basis that the district court substituted its judgment for that of the trial court when it found that this mitigating evidence necessarily had to be considered as mitigating. Obviously, the district court felt very strongly that this was mitigating evidence, but the trial court did not necessarily feel that way.
Well, no, we don't know what the trial court thought because the trial court doesn't say anything about the traumatic childhood. Other than he can't consider sympathy. He never deals with it again. So you're basically wanting us to go into the mind of the trial court judge and figure out.
The trial court recognized that this evidence was presented and also stated on the record that it was considering all the evidence presented.
except when it makes that final statement that the only thing he considers, the only thing that was mitigating is the extreme mental or emotional disturbance. That's a pretty strong statement. That's not ambiguous.
I believe that that doesn't show that as a matter of law he didn't consider it. He didn't consider the evidence presented to him, but again, the trial court did not necessarily have to believe that that was mitigating evidence. Also,
Ms. Griffin, isn't part of our problem that any reading of the state trial judge, the sentencing judge, carries with, he does have an exclusionary aspect to his comment, does he not? I mean, I understand your argument. That doesn't mean that he did exclude it, but he uses sympathy twice, and isn't that why we're a little bit at sea on what he did?
Yes, and I believe that his statement shows that he did not believe as a matter of law that he couldn't consider the evidence of the traumatic childhood. He specifically states for the record what he's not considering. Sympathy, who the victim was, outrage in the statement to the media. Sympathy and the underlying basis giving rise to the sympathy are not the same thing. The same argument has been rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Sample versus Parson, California versus Brown, albeit in a different context. In those cases, the petitioner was arguing that an instruction to the jury that it could not consider sympathy necessarily told the jury that it could not consider the underlying basis that might give rise to the sympathy, such as evidence of a bad upbringing. The United States Supreme Court stated that sympathy and any sympathetic aspect of the defendant's character or record giving rise to that sympathy is simply not the same thing. The trial court could have felt sympathy for the petitioner for having gone through this horrible childhood, but still felt that the horrible childhood which led him to become a murderer was aggravating in the sense that he had to look for a future dangerousness.
I would not disagree with that, but we do have to speculate that that's what he did do in light of his language. I understand the way you track the law and what he may well have done, but are we in some way trapped by his language where he says any matters dealing with sympathy, and I'll skip the rest because it's the outrage, who the victim was, all of that, in effect says any matters dealing with sympathy have no bearing on whether the defendant shall receive the death penalty. That I guess it's what he means by sympathy in this context. Isn't that our problem?
And I believe that what he means by sympathy, it speaks for itself. He was disregarding the sympathetic feeling he felt for the petitioner's upbringing.
Well, one in response to the question Judge Flom asked, you know, you're wanting us to make the leap that because he had a difficult childhood, well, that the judge considered the difficult childhood in the context of the mental illness, and that he evolved from this difficult childhood, and that was what was a factor in this mental illness and his ultimate conduct. But we don't have anything that, from the trial court that says that either, do we?
No, the trial judge does not specifically state that, although that is what the holding of the Illinois Supreme Court was, that it could be encompassed in that. But again, the trial court is not required to specifically state every single matter it considers in mitigation for the record and on the record. And again, it is the petitioner's burden to show a clear indication that the trial court believed as a matter of law it could not consider the evidence. And in this case, if there is any ambiguity, it should be looked at in favor of the respondent here. At best, the trial court statements are ambiguous, and it's a respondent's position that they're not ambiguous, especially when the trial court specifically states that it's considering everything presented and specifically states what it's not considering. And again, sympathy is not the same thing as the evidence of his childhood.
Well, he does, as I read it, I think, first mentioned sympathy, it is tied to his years in institutions, among other things.
Correct.
So when he then follows the next reference to sympathy as being an exclusion, do we have a problem since he linked perhaps just in passing as opposed to a specific finding or a reading of his understanding of the law, do we have the difficulty that the first sympathy reference has embodied in its phrasing this institutional involvement or his history, and then when he references sympathy again, it's in a context that I cannot. Now, maybe he's using it two ways. I suspect he may well have, that is the trial judge. It just leaves us a little at sea And I wonder when, on the question of whether or not, what's the burden, whether in this context of this case, that might not be sufficient.
I don't believe...
Didn't the Illinois Supreme Court, respectfully I say this, have to read into it to get to their conclusion?
To get to the conclusion that it was necessarily encompassed in its finding of extreme emotional distress, but also not considering sympathy has always been held to be an appropriate thing to not consider in mitigation. And I think that the judge's statements, reading them from the record, simply are explaining why he feels sympathy for the petitioner. And then he goes on to state that he's not considering the sympathy in mitigation. If I can briefly just address the suggestion that the respondent didn't raise this as a, that this was a factual issue before the district court, the petitioner doesn't raise any waiver on the state's part, and the petitioner can waive any claim that we've waived it by failing to raise it before this court. He does not claim that we did not raise this claim below, so therefore he's waived any claim that we didn't discuss the claim in the district court. If there's no further questions, I deserve...
I'm now completely lost.
What I'm saying is...
How many forfeitures were there in that? Double negatives are hard to understand, but...
What I'm saying is...
There were more than two in that last sentence.
Petitioner never claimed that we didn't raise this claim below.
Which claim?
The claim that the factual basis for the Eddings violation is not shown on the record.
Okay, I think I understand it now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Griffin. Mr. Friedman?
Counsel, Chief Judge, may it please the court. The district court here found an Eddings violation because the trial judge didn't consider all the mitigation that they had to consider, and which we heard, you heard the discussion of the abusive and traumatic childhood. And he reached that conclusion by looking clearly at the opinion order, which is attached to the in the appendix, and found that the trial judge did not consider the abusive and traumatic childhood.
The question I have for you,
sure,
is the same as the one I was really asking to your adversary. Whose decision is this? Is this a decision for a district judge to make, or is it a decision on a matter of fact for the state judge to make? We know that the Supreme Court of Illinois decided, though of course by a divided vote, that this trial judge had considered it, but he was simply unsympathetic in the end.
I think that, although not argued, and the Attorney General didn't argue it, I mean, the leading cases, I think it's Parker v. Duggar, they made it clear that what the High Court says about what factual findings the trial judge makes is a historical fact. And the Illinois Supreme Court, yes, made a fact that the trial judge considered this evidence. That's clear. But I think what...
So we've got a finding of fact by the state court, which presumably can be upset only on a, you know, it's a pretty steep... finding a fact by the state court.
They simply look to the opinion to see whether that ruling is fairly supported by the record. And I frankly think that that's what the district court judge did here. He looked to the record, he looked to the opinion of the trial court, and he looked to see whether the trial court considered the mitigation or not. And that's what he did. He looked.
It looked very much like the district judge made an independent judgment on this. But agreeing with Justice Simon isn't enough. Justice Simon was dissenting.
That's correct. I don't think he did make an independent at all. He looked to the actual opinion. I mean, that's what happened in Parker v. Duggar. Parker v. Duggar came, the Supreme Court said, it's a historical fact, you have to give some sort of deference to the High Court, the Florida Court, in that particular case. And then specifically looked at the opinion and said it wasn't fairly supported by the record. That is exactly what the district court did here. And he did it by saying, let's look what he did. Let's list all the mitigating
but
factors.
But now, if the argument is not that the district court's view is the right view, but that any other view is not supported by the record, I have a lot of trouble with it. Because it seems to me easy to read this statement two ways. One way, the one you argue for, the one the district court found, is that the judge is saying, I can't consider stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And the other, the judge is saying, I considered it, but I didn't find it very persuasive. He did not engage my sympathy. And as trier of fact, of course, he's free to do the latter, but he's not free to do the former.
But
there are two competing inferences.
That's correct. But I think that from looking at this, he, one, didn't take a look at the mitigation. He didn't look at this mitigating evidence and say, I really see this mitigation as aggravating, because he used the word sympathy. So this is not type of evidence that he looked at it in that sense as bad evidence. Two, he then proceeded to tell everybody what he was considering. He says, I went through and I looked at all possible mitigating factors, and he used the term within or without the statute, and found only the statutory extreme emotional disturbance at the time of the crime. And then proceeded to list all the aggravating factors, and not mentioning in the aggravating factors possibility of abusive and traumatic childhood. And so from there, all the district court did was, he looked to see what one he did, and looked at and he acknowledged what the Illinois Supreme Court did, and found it not fairly supported by the record. The second point is, and I want to make, and I think you can reach this from Eddings, and I think you can reach it from Lockett, you can reach it from Eddings, and even Southall and Brown. I mean, the sentencer has to listen to all the mitigating evidence. He can't exclude a lot of the evidence. He can exclude how the evidence is considered. And
you're not arguing that he excluded any evidence, are you?
He listened to the defendant. No, he didn't consider it. Consider it. And
he won't sway by it.
What? But I don't think he even did that. I think he didn't consider it as mitigation. I don't think he's looked at it and said, I'm unpersuaded by it. I considered abusive and traumatic childhood and then found it not carrying the day. He didn't say that. And he could have said that. In fact, he said, without repeating myself, once again, he was exhausted in what he did.
This strikes me as just, though, the problem of picking apart oral statements. Somebody is talking, and he isn't acting with the precision of writing, and alas, there are some state judges who, even when writing, aren't precise. And then we have this ambiguity problem, figuring out which of these two readings to give it.
That's why I
keep coming back to what
Illinois gave it. We've taken the position that it's not ambiguous, but let's assume for the moment that it is. Our position is that we win on the ambiguousness. And I believe a common opinion in the court really speaks for the coalition of the court on this issue, and the reason is that the cornerstone of death penalty jurisprudence, the new death penalty jurisprudence of 1976, is hinged on a narrowing factor of eligibility, and then the second factor of considering all the possible mitigation. And if it's not clear that the sentencer did not, the particularly judge, did not consider all the evidence, the petitioner wins. And usually,
but that amounts to saying that we give no weight at all to the Supreme Court of Illinois. Everybody agreed in the Supreme Court of Illinois, and I assume everybody here, that the statement is ambiguous. To say the defendant wins whenever the trial judge makes an ambiguous statement is precisely to say that the decision of the Supreme Court received no respect whatsoever.
Oh, I think it got respect.
It cannot resolve ambiguities.
It got respect, but when you look on this record, you look on the record, when you first list, when they list all the mitigating evidence.
No, look, you can pick a line. You can say the statement isn't ambiguous, therefore we win. But the argument you were just making is, whenever a statement is ambiguous, the defendant wins. And that line of argument is one that says the decision of the state court received no respect whatsoever.
Oh, I'm not saying you got no respect. I mean, when it's clouded by any degree of ambiguousness as to this type of violation, because I submit this violation doesn't require prejudice. It's it's one of the key elements of what people believe is what separates the old death penalty from the new death penalty. And the old death penalty was the judge didn't have to indicate what he was considering. There was restrictions as to what was available as mitigation. And notice, I mean, in the Garner case. And this particular element, and I think that's why O'Connor wrote that opinion. But I think she also used the term ambiguousness again in Parker v. Douglas. Very concerned. Supreme Court, I believe, is very concerned about these issues. I also think as a practical matter, this is an old case. This was a case that was heard in 1983. And you don't see too many any violations. And frankly, the judge knew what he was doing. I don't think he knew what was mitigation, what was appropriate to consider. I mean, they weren't up to speed with the case. Even the trial counsel,
I'd almost say the reverse. After you read all the Supreme Court cases, you wouldn't know what you're doing. Because anything could be aggravating or anything could be mitigating, and no limits can be placed on what's mitigating.
Yeah, but I think one of the general principles...
At the end of his career, Justice Blackmun said, it's all completely incoherent.
But I think
is inclined to agree with him.
No, I personally do too. But I think two general principles are the eligibility phase, narrowing it down, and the opportunity to submit what you want and have the sentence to listen to that. And I mean, even at one point, trial counsel was arguing, you get one mitigation in finding, you're out. The death penalty is out. This case was in its infancy stage. And I think the judge didn't consider it. Unless the court has any more questions on this issue, I'll move on to the next one. I'll point on the next claim very quickly. It's not procedurally defaulted. The district court judge ruled on the merit. What was procedurally defaulted was that the trial counsel stressed insanity rather than guilty but mentally ill and didn't put Trogin on and the guilty but mentally ill but saved them just for the sentencing phase. I think that's a good issue, but I think that was what was procedurally defaulted.
Let me return, if I may, to the first issue.
Sure.
In your research, and I recognize the commitment that you and your colleagues make in this area since you were after that, have you ever encountered any case reflecting a record where there's a judge saying what he will not exclude? What he will exclude, excuse me.
Yes, I think Eddings itself.
I mean, other than Eddings. I should have mentioned that.
My
focus in this case, as you may pick up from the question, is I think the error here is the hint of exclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't disagree with either you or my brother, Easterbrook, on the question of it seems like everything's in. So what troubles me here is a suggestion that something might be out.
Well, and that's what occurred here. That's what I mean, failure to consider. And that's his statement. I mean, you have
to. Well, it's even stronger, is it not? Isn't the suggestion will have no bearing. I mean, most of the records we get, there may be an omission to include. I don't know that. I don't want to get into doublespeak, but it's seldom that we have a suggestion what won't influence.
Yeah. I think that the quote, to repeat upon any matter dealing with sympathy, et cetera, I mentioned will have no bearing whether the defendant shall receive the death penalty, it should really clear up any ambiguity in favor of my client on that issue. I think what Judge Easterbrook said.
I think it might not be as ambiguous as it appears if he had an earlier reference to sympathy in connection with his institutionalization,
right,
which actually is a wellspring of part of the concern about his capacity, I guess.
I think the sympathy part that helps the client, it shows that it really is not aggravating. It's not the traditional double-edged sword. I have to concede, and I've had many dialogues in this court over the issue of whether my evidence is really aggravating rather than mitigating. But in this case, the judge didn't perceive it that way. He perceived that he couldn't consider it, that he was looking solely at the statutory mitigating and aggravating factors. And I think a lot of this occurred simply because it's an old case, and the judge didn't understand what he was supposed to do in the expansive of this. There's quite any other questions on the first claim. I just want to, since I don't get a chance to rebuttal, just indicate we believe that it's not procedurally defaulted. And we think that just the basic evidence in this case, since the cat was already out of the bag, he was arguing guilty but mentally ill. The issue was whether his background could give out a guilty but mentally ill verdict, ultimately to help the sentencing claim. The stuff that was excluded for no strategy reason at all, I think is important evidence. Low IQ, between 80 and 73, borderline mental deficiency. The Supreme Court is, I'm sure, well aware, debating what that all means in the Supreme Court case or whether they're going to have any bar on that. He had a long history of taking psychotropic drugs, including Thorazine. Even his adopted family really didn't want him, the father didn't want him, and that they were abusive towards him. And that also the evidence of, and I don't know whether the jury saw this or not, and this is one of the things, I've been representing this individual for about 10 years, his tremors. I mean, you don't have to be around him long enough to know that he has serious problems, both mentally and physically. And also the additional evidence of having neuropsychological dysfunction, which is probably consistent with his tremors and all his other problems. This was not simply a case of somebody having a shoe fetish. His problems were severely and very sick and led to a very tragic event. The court has any more questions of me, I urge that they affirm the district court as to the first claim and reverse a new trial for guilty but mentally ill.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. Ms. Griffin?
Regarding Your Honor's concern about the trial court stating for the record what it was not considering, I would just like to point out to the court that everything that the trial court said it was not considering is proper were proper things not to consider by the trial court. The trial court shouldn't have considered petitioner's statement to the media that he wanted to die. The trial court shouldn't have considered that the victim was a rape outreach counselor.
I guess I would say I agree with that. So how does that advance the ball?
I was just addressing it because it was addressed by Your Honor. And also sympathy is also a proper thing for the trial judge not to consider.
Yeah, my point though, Ms. Griffin, is if it had been a standalone reference to sympathy, I think that's one point. But if linkage of sympathy just shortly before with explaining in part what he meant by sympathy, at least that's the way I read it, was a tracking of the very history which forms the foundation, at least, of the argument that he's a mentally disturbed individual. So it's, I guess, trying to be forced to parse through the sympathy reference and linkage, as I see, and then de-linkage, so to speak, in the second reference that causes me some confusion.
I would respectfully suggest that was just the trial court explaining why it felt sympathy, and again, it's been held that you can't equate sympathy with the underlying basis. That was just his explanation. And again, if there is any ambiguity, a federal habeas court should abide by the choice of the Illinois Supreme Court on which way that ambiguity is to go. Petitioner suggests that in this context of a Eddings violation, a different standard is involved, but I don't believe he cites anything that stands for that proposition in his brief. It's also the respondent's position that his claim certified for appeal was procedurally defaulted. That specific claim was that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to get this specific evidence in support of a guilty but mentally ill verdict. The district court found that entire claim procedurally defaulted because of the independent and adequate state law ground of waiver. The Illinois Supreme Court found that entire claim waived and failed to reach the merits of that claim. The district court in this case did not piecemeal the claim and merely discussed the failure of counsel to get the medical records in a different context, in the context it was raised in petitioner's first post-conviction petition, regarding how it generally went to evidence of the petitioner's mental disturbance. In any event, both the trial, the state court and the district court found that there was no trial counsel error and that there was no prejudice in this case. And I would also like to point out that in his brief, petitioner mentions prejudice in the form of an acquittal. This was, the claim is that he failed to do this in support of a guilty but mentally ill verdict. That does not lead to an acquittal. It leads to a guilty but mentally ill verdict. There's no further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Griffin.
Thank you.
Mr. Friedman, thank you. And special thanks to you and your colleagues at the center for ably representing Mr. Wright in this matter. Case is taken under advisement. The court is in stands in recess. Thank you.